From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Today, stocks on Wall Street soared, showing optimism about an economic boost as more states reopen businesses, even as health officials warn that reopening too quickly could lead to a second wave of COVID-19.
And if that second wave happens, we may hear about it first in states that started reopening early, like Texas and Tennessee, which ended their stay-at-home orders nearly a month ago. Let's check in with both of those states. And joining us now from Nashville is WPLN reporter Blake Farmer, and from Austin, Texas, KUT reporter Jimmy Moss. Welcome to both of you. And Blake, Nashville is now in its second phase of reopening. What do things look like right now?
Yeah, you know, Nashville, which is the state capital, has been a little slower than Tennessee as a whole. You know, like playgrounds are still closed here in town, for instance. But you now in Tennessee have gyms open, salons, restaurants have fewer restrictions on capacity. You know, even musical performances are now allowed, so long as there is this sort of 15-foot spit buffer around the performer. Some religious congregations have started meeting again, but for the most part, they're being encouraged to hold off. Lots of summer camps have decided not to try this year, though some are giving it a whirl. And you know, families are deciding, you know, do we take that beach trip? And a lot of them are saying, yeah, let's head down to Florida for the week.
Well, and Jimmy, in Austin, summer camps will be opening in Texas, but how is reopening unfolding there in general?
Well, in general, we are taking it slower here, probably in the capital than the rest of the state. Really, the reopening depends on what metro area you're in and what part of the state you're in. More rural areas are finding themselves free to sort of heed the governor's advice and reopen ad hoc. So it is an option. So not every business is taking him up on that. But you're right. In-person summer camps start next week, and childcare centers are open again. So presumably parents can work at all of those places that are reopening.
Well, and just to be clear, it's not in either of your states kind of a free-for-all back to business as usual. I want to listen here to what the governors have said specifically. Here is Texas Governor Greg Abbott in a press conference earlier this month.
Our goal is to find ways to coexist with COVID-19 as safely as possible. That includes maintaining safe distances, wearing a mask, sanitizing your hands.
Okay, and then here is the Tennessee Governor Bill Lee at a press conference just a few days ago.
Social distancing continues to mitigate the spread of this virus, which still exists in our communities. As we go out, as we do the things that we're beginning to do, social distancing is a part of the way that we do this and address it safely.
So let me ask each of you, starting with you, Blake, are people wearing masks in general outside?
Especially outside, no. I mean, you'll see some, and I'd say if you're in Nashville, you're more likely to see them than if you go into the, you know, the rest of the 95 counties outside of urban areas. But even, you know, businesses in Nashville got a bit of a scolding this morning from Nashville's public health director. He was downtown on Lower Broadway, which is the big tourist area with the honky tonks, and it's kind of been revived. And, you know, he was not seeing nearly as many masks as he'd like. And he was really coming down hard on businesses to say, we need your help to sort of make this the norm.
And Jimmy, what about in Austin, Texas, where you are?
Austin, I would say 70%, roughly speaking, are compliant with masks, though a few weeks ago, that number was probably higher than 80. Other major metros, probably slightly better than 50%. But the rest of Texas really depends on your age and health. And a lot of the folks have really taken to heart some of the mixed messages that they're getting from leaders. Many have held steadfast to the fact that a mask is not mandatory. I spoke to a business owner yesterday in Port Aransas, which is a beach town that is dependent on tourism, had a big holiday weekend. She said it was crowded, and if it weren't for one or two masks that she saw, she said you would not have known coronavirus was even a thing.
Okay, let me just finally ask each of you very briefly, are you seeing a second spike, Blake?
We're, you know, if you look at sort of the 2 week average, there's a bit of a rise, but it's certainly nothing that public health officials are calling a spike.
Mm-hmm. And what about you, Jimmy?
Cases are up, but the number of hospitalizations are down, which is what the governor is using to justify these moves.
That is Jimmy Moss, reporter at KUT in Austin, Texas, and Blake Farmer at WPLN in Nashville. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, Florida felons who have completed their prison sentences and parole terms are one step closer to regaining their right to vote after a federal court ruled against a state law that would have denied felons the right to vote until they paid off outstanding fines and court fees. In 2018, Florida voters passed an amendment to the state constitution, automatically restoring the right to vote to people convicted of felonies once they completed their sentences. But last year, state lawmakers restricted that right to those who had also paid off their court-related debts. On Sunday, Judge Robert Hinkle said that amounts to a pay-to-vote system and it's unconstitutional. Desmond Mead is president of the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition, which backed the referendum granting voting rights to felons. Desmond, Judge Hinkle said this state law violated the 24th Amendment against poll taxes. You spent 3 years in prison after a drug charge conviction. Did you have to pay off fines and fees?
Yeah, yes, I did. You know, matter of fact, I did more than just pay off my fines and fees. I even paid off the court costs. But unfortunately, many of the people who have felony convictions in the state of Florida cannot afford to pay their fines and fees. Because, I mean, when you look at it, you know, you have people who with criminal convictions, they have a hard time dealing with these collateral consequences, such as employment. And, you know, they're not making a ton of money and they're barely making ends meet. And so to be able to ask a person to choose between whether having their lights cut off or being evicted as opposed to paying off a fine and fee, I think that's unconscionable.
And we should say people convicted of murder or a felony sex offense are not covered by the judge's ruling on Sunday. They have to go through a clemency board to regain some of their rights. But to those who have been convicted of felonies and are unable to pay fees and fines they've accrued in the courts, Judge Hinkle said that those fees should not be a barrier to voting. Can you give us a sense how much do felons typically owe the court and how many of them are unable to pay?
It's in the hundreds of millions of dollars collectively. With the returning citizens that we've been dealing with, we've been seeing an average of around $1,500. But either way, you know, no matter what that individual may owe in fines or restitution, this ruling basically has said that if a person is unable to pay that amount of money, that that would not be a barrier to them voting. We're ecstatic about this decision, but we're also cautiously optimistic because we know, as in any type of litigation, that this could go to appeal. And it could quite very well see itself before the United States Supreme Court.
And by the way, Judge Hinkle isn't contesting a state's right to disenfranchise people, take away the right to vote. He said a state may do that and may impose conditions on their re-enfranchisement. Do you worry in that he is saying states have the right to take away the right to vote, that Florida will find another way?
You know, every state have that right to take away the right to vote. That has not necessarily been the problem. The problem has been restoring that right, you know, and the state of Florida at one point never did. I mean, you faced a lifetime bar from voting once convicted in Florida. Judge Hinkle's ruling, what it does is prevent the state from using any type of administrative maneuvering that would hinder or create obstacles for an individual who is trying to get the right to vote back. And the tone of that ruling basically prohibits the state from doing anything that would create any kind of barrier to voting.
What do you say to people who say, wait a minute, I'm not allowed to not pay fees I accrue, who think this is just letting somebody off and letting the taxpayer pick up the tab?
Well, one of the things about the judge's ruling is that, and it's been very consistent with what we've been saying from day one, is that there are two types of financial obligations that are associated with a conviction. One type are those costs that are intimately connected to the offense that a person was convicted. There is an obligation there to pay that, but that obligation to pay that should not be a barrier to voting if that individual does not have the ability to pay those fines or that restitution. right? But the other cost, the court costs and these other fees that are added on, those are financial obligations that's required as a cost of doing business in court. And those are other taxes and definitely were unconstitutional.
Desmond Meade, president of the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition. Desmond, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Here's a TV channel I haven't thought about in a while, QVC.
So we save you almost $37 off the retail price here at QVC.
If you have lavender planted in your backyard, this is a great color to balance with it.
The biggest upgrade of all is actually this easy reach handle.
We've got a today's special value price that will go away at the end of the day.
It turns out that as Americans have been stuck at home more than usual over the past few months, many have been turning to home shopping channels. QVC and HSN have seen higher viewership this March and April than last year. Joining us now as part of our series of conversations with leaders called View from the Top is Mike George, who's president and CEO of Qurate Retail. That's the parent company of both QVC and HSN. Mike George, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you, Jeremy. It's good to be with you.
Well, so viewership is up. Tell us more about that. How has business been at QVC and HSN since the start of the shelter-in-place orders back in March?
You know, initially when the shelter-in-place orders first started to take off in mid-March, we saw an immediate pullback in consumer spend. Once kind of the initial shock of the shelter-in-place started to wear off, we started to see a rebound in our engagement, which is really what we focused on. And we think of engagement as how many people are viewing us, how many people are visiting our websites, and really saw that start to take off in late March. And the sales followed. So we've been pleased with the customer response over the last several weeks. I think we've been able to be a service to her as she's tried to navigate this new environment.
Well, and is it because people are just flipping through the channels and they want something that's not depressing, like about the news, and they just would rather watch QVC, or are they just in the market for more goods that they want to buy?
You know, I think it's really both of those things. So you're definitely seeing a consumer who is at home and certainly spending more time watching TV and more time online. So we said to our team, we want to be an antidote to the depressing news cycle. We just want to be a place of respite, a place you can come to, be hopefully engaged, entertained. We didn't really know whether she would be in the mood to buy anything or not, but if we could be there for her, we thought that would be meaningful and just be a kind of a source of inspiration for her.
By the way, I noticed, and I'm sure our listeners do too, that you keep saying she and her. I assume you also have male viewers.
About 85 to 90% of our sales are to women. So we do focus more on women customers. So we tend to personalize it with the kind of language I've used. It's just ingrained in how we think about her as a real person leading a real life and how we can speak to her as an individual. But we do have some men customers as well, myself included.
Well, here is one of your hosts pitching the Teeter Fitspine Inverter, which is a table that lets you turn yourself upside down. Listen.
It is so beautiful to hear from all of you how your lives really have been changed by just inverting for a couple minutes a day. Having to, you know, one of our callers earlier, not having to go to physical therapy, which we really couldn't do right now anyway.
Have you had to tailor the products that you're selling to the moment that we're in right now?
Very much so. We've never seen in the history of our company such a fundamental shift in what she's buying. She is really not as interested in our fashion product right now. Sales in apparel, accessories are down. Sales in jewelry are down. But she's very interested in a lot of things for the home, including taking care of herself. And so we've seen enormous growth in a variety of health-related products, fitness-related products. She's buying a lot of cooking products, decor products. She's buying outdoor products. So yes, a really fundamental change in her purchase behavior.
Now, as a broadcaster myself, I know that nearly everybody on our team is broadcasting from home. Are all your hosts broadcasting from home as well?
So we still have our hosts mostly coming to our studios simply because that's where our product is. So we're running these very skinny live studios with maybe a third or less of the team members that we would normally have. And that's true in all of our studios around the world. And then all of the guests, they're Skyping in from home. And one of the really interesting things that's happened as we've gone to that approach, we thought customers and viewers might really be really disappointed in kind of a loss of professionalism or quality. But in fact, she's loved the intimacy of coming into people's homes, seeing our guests in their kitchen. It's a real learning for us that I think we can take forward once we're behind this pandemic.
And are you seeing supply chain problems or shipping issues when people do buy things? I know that, you know, nearly everything that I have bought during this pandemic has taken longer than it used to get to me.
We are. So we're definitely taking longer to ship than we would like to be. And we've tried to be very transparent with our customers about that. One of the huge impacts of this pandemic is that we've had to rethink all of our processes in our fulfillment centers. And that meant strict rules about how to do social distancing. It meant eliminating all the normal productivity standards because we wanted the message to be clear. We want you to be safe, not fast. We gave all our fulfillment center team members the option to stay home if they were uncomfortable at any time for any reason or to leave at any point during the day or to come in late. We even offered to pay them partial pay to stay home.
How was business on QVC and HSN before this pandemic?
Sales have been a little bit softer as we started to really adjust to a new environment where you're seeing people cutting the cord, as everyone talks about, less people in the pay TV ecosystem. So we've been hard at work at trying to bring our brand to life on all sorts of new media, live streaming, on Facebook, on our own digital apps, on YouTube, and replace that gradually but still declining TV viewership with new forms of viewership. And so we were sort of down the path in making that pivot when the pandemic struck. Definitely we saw sales freeze for a week or two, but then come back very strongly.
Mike George, while we have you, I want to ask you about the other role that you have, which is you're the chairman of the board of the National Retail Federation. And as you know, retail in general has taken a big hit in this crisis. Major retailers, including J. Crew and JCPenney, have declared bankruptcy. There are a lot of small businesses that are worried they may never reopen. What kind of situation are you looking at when you look at retail in America right now? What are you worried about?
It's certainly been an enormously challenging time with all the store closures, and we worry especially about small businesses. So we've been proud as an industry association to be able to first focus on advocacy and helping influence the CARES package and trying to get support to the retail community. We then shifted our focus to just how do we start to reopen retail in a safe way and try to, as an industry, to have shared practices for how we keep the public safe and keep our team members safe as we reopen. And now we're looking forward to how to innovate and return to growth, because I do believe, as tough as this is, one bright spot for the retail community at large would be it has just forced and accelerated a level of innovation that was already ongoing. But in this kind of environment where you've got to make bigger, bolder changes faster, I'm excited about the pace of innovation. I think we're seeing 3 years worth of innovation in 3 months. I believe that's true in our company. I believe it's true for the industry. And so are there going to be a lot of financial losses out of this? Yes. Will there be retailers, sadly, who go out of business? Yes. But I think the industry comes through strongly because we focus on digital innovation, but it's been a tough couple months and we have some tough months in front of us.
Well, how likely do you think that it is? And I know, you know, nobody knows exactly what's going to happen, but how likely do you think that it is that 6 months from now, if you walk down any main street in America, that you're just going to see a lot of stores that aren't there anymore, empty storefronts?
I'm sure we're going to see some of that. I don't know that we're going to see a lot of that. It certainly depends on how quickly the consumer rebounds. But we are worried about the small businesses. You know, one of the programs as part of our COVID relief package that we did at Curate, actually in partnership with the NRF, was to donate a chunk of our airtime to promoting 20 small retailers around the country. And the goal of that was very simple, not just to motivate consumers to go to those 20 retailers, but more importantly, to motivate consumers to go out and support your small retailer in your community. The large retailers will do fine. They'll get through this with some pain. But go out and support that small retailer. I think that's the best way we can all ensure that Main Street is still crowded and busy going forward if we just support our small business community.
Let me just finally ask you, if there is somebody listening to this who's either a member of Congress or a member of the Senate or a member of the Trump administration, what would you say to them about what businesses need right now?
I think the CARES package has been enormously beneficial. The key thing is just to, we have to make sure we effectively spend all the money that has already been allocated through CARES. And I think there's a variety of programs that could further support not just small businesses, but mid-sized businesses that are going through liquidity challenges. And then at the same time, keep an eye on the consumer. I think the stimulus checks have helped many retailers as those dollars start to get back into our economy. And you just have to pay attention to how that consumer responds and rebounds, and if there's more we need to do on that front.
Do you think there needs to be another CARES package that is as big as the last one?
It's probably too early to tell. I certainly think there needs to be more than where we are today. But, you know, we're still in the early stages of this crisis, and I suspect more will need to be done.
That is Mike George, who is the president and CEO of Qurate Retail. That's the parent company of QVC and HSN. He's also the chairman of the board of the National Retail Federation. Mike George, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Facebook, Twitter, and Square are among the growing list of tech companies whose CEOs have acknowledged that working from home could become the norm for their industry long after the pandemic is over. Let's bring in Ronnie Mola, who is senior data reporter for Recode. Ronnie, Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook said last week that as many as half of that company's employees could be working remotely within the next 5 to 10 years. Do you think that that was the tipping point? Are all tech companies going to have a sizable portion of their workforce outside the office?
I think that's absolutely the case. People working at tech companies have been talking about the ability to work from anywhere for basically as long as the internet has existed. And for a number of reasons, that hasn't really happened. But I do think that the pandemic is sort of the last push it needed for a lot of tech companies to say, hey, this is something that is possible and something that we can do and something that could probably save them a lot of money.
Well, yeah, these companies have invested collectively billions of dollars into corporate campuses and offices over the past 2 decades or so. Do you think that they'll end up selling some of that real estate if everybody starts working from home?
You know, I'm not sure. There are various reasons why tech companies and other companies have thought that it's better to be in the office, at least some of the time. I can't see that they'd completely get rid of these beautiful campuses. However, you could certainly see that they might want to downsize them or maybe not add any more going forward, especially if they have a workforce that's a lot more scattered across the country and world.
Well, and do you have any sense of what the office will look like for those employees who do work from the office? We know that they've, you know, long had these perks on the campuses of tech companies like employee dining and even massages and gyms. And generally, open offices that where everybody sits next to each other. Is that going to continue?
There's going to have to be a lot of different considerations put in place to make people feel safe to come back to the office. And one of the things that, from talking to a bunch of different experts, I think is going to happen is that it might be the end of the open office. Someone said it might be the recubicalization of space, or maybe a much nicer looking version of cubicles, glass or plastic, in order to sort of separate the space. Another thing that I think is going to happen, and part of this is because a lot of people will be allowed to work from home, is that there will just be fewer people in the office in general. That will allow people to sort of sit further apart from one another. But the interesting thing is that that sort of contradicts the whole idea of the open office, the idea that you could have these serendipitous interactions with your colleagues, that you sort of overhear what they're saying and you end up talking to them. But now, you know, we're sort of closing that off for safety's sake.
One more thing I want to ask you about is salaries. A lot of these workers for, you know, Facebook, Apple, Google, they work in one of the most expensive places in the world, which is the San Francisco Bay Area, and they live there. If somebody decides they want to go work from home in Indianapolis or India, for that matter, are they still going to get paid a California salary?
I believe Mark Zuckerberg said that they would have to sort of reconsider salaries for people working elsewhere, you know, to sort of make it more in line with the cost of living of that place. So maybe you aren't getting the same as you would if you were living in the Bay Area, but it costs so much less to live. You could buy a house for so much less. You could, you know, buy groceries for so much less. So maybe that evens out.
That is Rani Mulla, who's a senior data reporter for Recode. Rani, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
New York City, the city that never sleeps, a vibrant soundscape of construction, trains, traffic. New Yorkers hear it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You know, this. But now, it's this. Crickets. And New Yorkers are missing their soundscape. I know when I lived there, I couldn't sleep without a little noise. So now a new album from the New York Public Library is giving a sense of the sounds that have been lost. It's called Missing Sounds of New York, an auditory love letter to New Yorkers. There's the track Romancing Rush Hour. We hear a man running for a cab.
Taxi!
Then construction sounds. A city musician accepting contributions from a passerby. Missing Sounds of New York, an auditory love letter to New Yorkers, is on Spotify. And the New York Public Library's website, bless them. We'll link you at herenow.org. Carrie Welch is the Director of External Relations at this magnificent library. She joins us with more. Welcome.
Thank you.
Are you a New Yorker?
Born and bred.
Exactly. How does it feel, missing the sound?
You know, it took a little while to, you know, really identify that the sounds were missing. So much felt so different and strange and surreal. And, you know, quiet is a nice thing, and we all like and need a little quiet. But when a city is really sort of in your soul as a bustling, cacophonous place, it was really an empty feeling that the sounds were no longer there.
Yeah. And I know you were working with a creative agency on projects to celebrate your library's 125th anniversary, and this seemed like a good idea.
Yeah. We had been talking to Mother New York about sort of a wider reaching campaign for the library. And this came up during a brainstorming session. And 3 weeks later, it was on the air. So we don't usually work that fast. It was quite something.
Well, it's interesting. Last year, we did a story on the Sounds of New York City project, and this is a project to collect sounds from around New York to help reduce the amount of noise pollution, you know, by drawing attention to it. Let's just listen to the little sound they collected. It's so funny that that, you know, is considered sound pollution. People, they're worried about people's ears. I love that sound, and now that it's gone, you know, as you said, people are missing it.
They are. I mean, I don't think when you're living day-to-day in New York City, you think of, I mean, there's certainly times when you're like, oh my goodness, when, you know, this is too much, or some really horrendous sound undoes you, but in general, I think that it's sort of, as I said earlier, it really is sort of like a part of you, and you don't realize that it could be damaging your ears or, you know, other awful things. When it went away, that felt like it was damaging people. And so part of what we do is at the library, you know, is bring communities together. And this was one way to bring communities together around something that I think people were all feeling, all New Yorkers were feeling, whether they knew it or not. But I think the response plays that out.
Oh, I want to hear about that, but let's hear a little more first of what they're responding to. This is Out in Left Field, another track, which takes us to a baseball game, and someone in the crowd reacting to a call. Wasn't sure we could play that. And is, I don't know if that's Shea or Yankee, but that sense of, you know, being out at a ball game, a reminder that we're not going to be in crowds like that for a while.
Exactly. And also, I mean, baseball games, whether you're a baseball fan or not, but it is such a sort of American sound of summer. And we are very strongly attached to our baseball teams here. And so that sound, the fact that the baseball season wasn't going to open is really a pretty poignant missing sound.
Yeah. Here's another from the train, a swiping of the Metro card as you hear the train rumbling. I love trains.
To me, this is the most evocative piece because I never in a million years thought I would miss anything about the subway. but oddly, I do. And I miss the sounds. I miss the characters. I miss the performers, which you also hear on this track. Hey! I think a lot of people feel strongly about missing this artery that connects us all, the New York subway system.
Right. What are you hearing from people?
You know, I have to say the response has been tremendous. I think there have been about 300,000 streams in 70 different countries, which is phenomenal. There must be New Yorkers all over the world, or something about the sounds that everybody remembers from a trip here or can relate to in their own city. And it's been so positive. I mean, it definitely makes some people very sad, but in kind of a positive way. And I think people mostly are looking forward to those sounds coming back.
And what's the one, if you had to pick one, they miss the most?
I think the sounds of people is what people miss the most. You know, there's something deeply human about this playlist. Even though it's mostly sounds, it has human stories on top of each kind of soundscape. So I think the sounds that people made is what people miss the most.
That's Carrie Welch, Director of External Relations at the New York Public Library, which, by the way, is closed to the public, but they've been providing digital content for the public and researchers. And this recording, Missing Sounds, an Auditory Love Letter to New Yorkers. Oh, Carrie, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin. Thank you so much.
Let's hear now from a young person, a high schooler. In Reno, Nevada, high school junior Janelle Olisea has been keeping an audio diary to record her experience stuck in the house, learning remotely during a pandemic. Here's one of her entries.
The last time I was out was March 13, which was the Friday before spring break started. And my friends and I were joking when we were out. We were at Starbucks. We were like, you know, what if we won't see each other for another month? And, you know, life has a sense of humor, because clearly that joke became a reality. But that was the real time I was out for anything that wasn't essential. And since then, I've only been out probably max 5 times. And those were all for grocery shopping. And, you know, I try to stay at home for as much as possible because I want to protect my family. I live with my grandma and my parents, and obviously older people are more susceptible to the virus. I just want to keep them safe. I don't want to, you know. It's a scary time. Being stuck at home has really made me appreciate all the moments that I guess I took for granted before. You know, we can complain how much schoolwork we have. We can complain about having to get up early for school. We can complain about every single aspect of our life. But I guess quarantine has really made me appreciate the things that I really took for granted, because I miss being outside. I even miss getting up early to get ready for school. That's crazy. I miss hugging my friends. I miss being able to see them every day. I miss, like, making plans on the weekends with them. I just miss everything about what life was like before this all happened. And I guess being stuck at home has really opened my eyes to how carelessly we can take things for granted sometimes. And I really hope that after quarantine, I can fully appreciate every single hug, every single handshake, being able to go outside and not wear a mask and gloves. I really hope that out of quarantine, it really impacts me in a positive light, and I'm a better person because of it.
Janelle Olisea, a junior at the Academy of Arts, Careers, and Technology High School in Reno, Nevada. Her audio diary was produced by member station KUNR's youth program in partnership with the Washoe County School District to train the next generation of journalists.
As companies have struggled to make ends meet, one way they've tried to avoid layoffs is by cutting retirement benefits for employees. Amtrak, Lazy Boy, Marriott International are just a few of the companies that are freezing or cutting 401k matches in order to weather the current economic crisis. For more, let's bring in Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
So the average employee with a 401k saves about $10,000 per year toward retirement, with $3,500 of that coming from what the employer puts in as a match. That is a voluntary benefit that some companies offer. But how widespread is the removal of that benefit right now?
So far, not widespread. According to Fidelity Investments, they are the largest employer-based plan manager, and they say that two-thirds of companies that have plans with them are not planning to do any sort of suspension or cut to their retirement benefits or their 401k match. Fewer than 10% are cutting. Now, this, of course, is sort of reminiscent of where we were in the financial crisis, where a lot of companies did actually suspend. Something in the order of around 20% of companies actually reduced their 401k benefits.
Well, and my company back then in 2008 in the financial crisis did just that. They pulled the match on the 401k. But why is that often the first thing to go?
Well, I think it seems to be an easier thing to say, hey, we're all in this together. We're all going to pull back on this match because we're going to suffer together. And if the alternative is you have no job versus losing a benefit like your 401k match, I think most employees would say, hey, you know what? We'll all do it. And this will probably be temporary. And I think that companies are quite concerned that making big cuts now are it's going to be real detrimental to the well-being of their employees. And I think if you know that this is short-term in nature, perhaps this will make it easier to navigate the, you know, it's bad news, but it's not, I've lost my job.
Were they short-term back then? Did they all come back?
Well, I wouldn't say every single one, but I'd say most did. And you know, if you look at the numbers, I think it took about 12 months where, you know, sort of like 2009 was a bad year. But by the end of 2010, it was just fewer than 1% had cut back. So I think that if you could say as a company, hey, we did this in the recession or we hope this is short term, it's an easier message to deliver.
Well, and it is something that people won't feel immediately, especially if they're farther away from retirement. But what should people do, Jill, if their employer has stopped contributing during this downturn? It's obviously still important to save for retirement.
Well, I think that if you hear this from your employer, you know, you don't then make the knee-jerk reaction of, oh, my God, I'm not getting my free money. I'm not going to put money in. And unfortunately, back in 2008, 2009, about 20% of workers that worked for companies that did suspend those 401k matches, those people just stopped saving entirely for the whole year. And that's a shame because we really do need people to do more than their employer match. So maybe if you could afford it, and I know everyone can't, but let's just presume you're single, you're working, and you say, okay, I'm still working, I have my money, I've kept my job. How about you knock up your employer, your contribution by maybe 2 or 3 percentage points to make up for the fact that your boss isn't doing that? And then what would be really great is if that 401k gets reinstated, you keep the same level. You know, so much of this is habit, Jeremy, and if we can just get people to put a little bit more in automatically, it does do amazing things to your retirement planning over the longer term.
Well, and over the longer term, we have seen the 401k kind of replace the traditional pension that used to exist in a lot of places. Now, if the 401k is being, you know, pulled back on a little bit, at least by employers, where do you see all this going for workers?
This is not a great trend, and it's a long-term trend, as you said. You know, like, the 1980s is when we start to see the pension plan for many private companies disappear, replaced by the 401k. I don't think that pensions are necessarily coming back anytime soon. I think that most people really know that that's a bygone era. I think that in the future, the problem is that you cannot count on this 401k match as the promised salvo. Now, it's great when things are going well, but obviously, you've got to make sure it's there for you. And, you know, the onus is on you. That's the problem with a 401k. It was sold to us as this great benefit. It's great. It's great when the market's going up. It's great when your company's matching. But when things turn, it's you. And that means that we have to actually bear that burden as individuals. And it's a heavy burden. It's why retirement saving remains a key problem among so many workers. They just don't have enough money, and not enough companies make it a standard benefit. And we've done a good job with health insurance that for many companies, yes, we do have health insurance. We need to make the 401k sort of the equivalent of health insurance.
That is Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Jill, thanks as always.
Take care.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here Now.